Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum. We also welcome listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce moderator Alexis Coe, writer and historian, for a discussion about the most important, often wondrous, sometimes bizarre, and occasionally downright vexing items that make up a museum's special collections. She'll be joined by a panel of curators from the Asian Art Museum, Stanford's Cantor Center for the Arts, the Oakland Museum of California, and the San Francisco History Center of the Public Library. The curators will discuss their particular museum's collecting strategies, acquisitions, stories, and treasures from their archives. And Alexis, take it away.
Hello. Thank you, Anne. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club and all of you for coming. I am delighted to be here tonight. The timing of this panel is especially meaningful, as this week marks the one-year anniversary of my column, Recent Acquisitions. All of the panelists sitting before you have aided me in that process, one week at a time, and I am so grateful for their contributions, in addition to their presence here tonight. Cultural institutions offer visitors exhibitions, education, and special programs, but they have a far loftier goal, one we do not see from the gallery. They serve as our collective memory. As you can imagine, that is no easy task. And tonight is all about learning how these curators managed to do it so very well. We'll begin with a short introduction from each of the panelists. I asked them to choose a few images as a way to speak to their institution's collecting strategies. We'll begin with Susan Goldstein, our own city's archivist. Susan works in the History Center, which is located in the main branch of the San Francisco Public Library, and also contributes to their blog, one of my personal favorites, On the Sixth Floor. Susan.
Okay, thank you. So I'm the odd woman out, because we're not really a museum. We're an archives and rare book room, but we do collect, and in fact, we have some overlapping collections with everybody here tonight. So I'm really pleased to be here. And let's take a look at some of the things that we do. I wasn't sure what order this would come up. This is a recent collection that came in last year. This is the Grace Miller papers, and it's mixed materials, it's ephemera, it's photographs, it's correspondence, and it's a small collection from Grace Miller, who ran a lesbian bar in North Beach in the 1950s. And it's one of the first documents we have of gay and lesbian bars in San Francisco. She was later arrested. There was a raid for contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and she went to jail. But some of the points I want to make about this are that gay and lesbian collections are a huge amount of what we collect. It's very important, very core to our collecting mission. And it's a very popular collecting area. When we started, when I came to the library 17 years ago, it was very easy to get these. People didn't want them so much. Now there's a lot of competition. So a lot of people want these collections, and people are starting to charge money for them, whereas people used to donate them. So these are some of the issues that come up for me when I deal with them. Many researchers use these. They're among our most popular, most used by students, grad students, professors, filmmakers. A lot of the AIDS films that were made last year, people used our collections. Mixed materials, we get those a lot. Those have some problems for us behind the scenes as we process them and try to figure out separating the photos and how to make sure everything stays together intellectually. So that's kind of a process for the archivists on our staff. We have about six of them. Other issues come up. Do we collect papers of famous people only? She wasn't a famous person. If you look at the Huntington Library, that's starting to collect some very famous gay and lesbian writers. They probably wouldn't take these papers. But these are really significant for us because it shows life in San Francisco. It's very representative. But often we have to make a choice. Do we take everybody's diaries, or do we just take the most interesting diaries from a certain period? You know, how do we select what we're going to take? And then a lot of these collections are modern, so they raise a lot of issues for us about confidentiality and copyright. Sometimes I say the best donor is a dead donor. And that's because often an older collection is easier for us to handle. So we'll have collections and somebody will be writing to all their boyfriends and girlfriends in the 1970s. And, you know, those people are still around. It's very recent. And just to throw out a couple examples, we had some diaries donated last year. They were processed by an archivist. We put them in our catalog so people could find them, and we put them on the Online Archives of California, and we did a blog post about them. And we were contacted by the donors, two friends of this man who had died of AIDS, and they were very upset, saying that you talk about his drug use and his sex, and his parents are in their 90s, and they're still alive, and if they see all this go up, they might find it and be horrified and come see them. And this just happened 2 weeks ago. And, you know, this kind of thing happens all the time, you know, and did you tell us you didn't want us, that you wanted them suppressed? No, they didn't say that when they donated them. So there's a host of issues that come up with this collection, these collections. Okay, these are San Francisco Police Department records. On the right is a mugshot book, mostly of prostitutes. And on the left is a letter about, I think it's about violence during the 1907 streetcar strike. So we are the city archives. According to city administrative code, city departments must give their historical materials to us. And we have a lot of them, and it's a great resource for us. We have some wonderful collections. Let's see, we have mayoral papers, the medical examiner records, Department of Public Works. We have about 10,000 beautiful photographs of the city. All kinds of things that you wouldn't think of as being in city papers. This represents to me our backlog. This is a collection that has been there since I've been there, and now an archivist, we always had some kind of access to it, but finally somebody is working on it the way I would like to see it worked on and made available to the public, and it's finally going to go up on the Online Archives of California. So that's one of our big problems, is getting to these collections with staff. This also raises a question for me. That mugshot book on the right, we have a number of mugshot books. I see this as historical material. Historians use it. This is vernacular photography. Just in December, Swan Gallery in New York had a San Francisco Police Department mugshot book for sale for $10,000. Now, it didn't come from our collection. It left the police department in city custody at some time and went on sale. I couldn't afford it, and it actually sold for $30,000. So this raises a lot of issues for me about collectors and purchases and things that escape city custody, and can we ever have them together and ever have the complete set again? And this is the third mugshot book from San Francisco I've seen up for sale over the years, so I can't stand that. And then this last one, this is a collection that just came the last week of December. We are receiving a large photograph collection from a collector. It's all San Francisco photographs. This first shipment, we picked up about 830 glass plate negatives, and that's what you're looking at there. I put them on a light table so we could take a picture. Some are from known photographers like Willard Worden, early 1900s, and then some from Gabriel Moulin. The issue for us for these is storage and preservation. You know, how do we store these? It's hard to take care of glass plates, and also access, and the expectation now is that we do digitizing. So I'm looking at this collection to see, are we going to digitize it? And if we do, are we going to put metadata with it, information on it, or maybe we're just going to throw it up and let people crowdsource it and put it up on our Flickr page? So we're looking at different practices in the profession also. So that's just a start.
Thank you, Susan. Yeah. We'll hear from Elizabeth Kathleen Mitchell next, who is the curator of prints, drawings, and photographs at Stanford's Cantor's Art Center.
Great. Thank you, Alexis. I cover prints, drawings, and photographs. So this evening I brought one work that represents each of those specialized areas. Each is a recent acquisition that either builds on a strength that we have or points toward a direction that I want to take our collection into. This is a drawing. It looks kind of fat, drawn out there. It's more of a vertical thing. But this is by a Boston artist named John Wilson. He was born in 1922, and he's still going. a really influential teacher in the Boston area. He went to the Museum of Fine Arts School, and when he got pretty far into his studies, he told his teachers, "I want to go to Mexico. I want to study with José Clemente Orozco." And they said, "Well, that's nice, but you need to go to France first." So he did, and he ended up spending a few years in the workshop of Fernand Léger, not bad. And then he came back to Boston, and then he got a fellowship that enabled him to go to Mexico, and he made prints in the 1950s at the Taller de Gráfica Popular, which was the most influential, most important printmaking workshop in Mexico City. And this is a drawing. It's on very thin paper. But it's a preparatory drawing for a lithograph. It's done in graphite, ink, and lithographic crayon, and it was done in 1951. I think it's just a gorgeous thing. It's combining French modernism and Mexican modernism, and as an African-American artist working in the 50s, he was very interested in issues of labor and modernity and urbanity. And so you see all of this come together in a really smart way in this drawing. And when I acquired it, it was a preparatory drawing for a lithograph. I also acquired an impression of the lithograph because as a teaching institution for the Cantor, it's really wonderful to be able to show process, demonstrate process. And there are these lovely, subtle, fine differences where you see him working out the composition between the drawing and the final lithograph. To speak to prints, my primary area of interest is 18th century Britain, but that means I also have to acknowledge France. So this is, grudgingly, this is a gorgeous, it's an etching and engraving after a painting by Antoine Watteau. This was executed by an engraver named Pierre-Alexandre Aveline after Watteau's Gersaint signboard. So this print was made around 1732. And it's a very big print. It's very bold, very crisp, very clear. What I appreciate about this print is not just that it provides, it provides this very interesting case study in what prints do. There was one painting. Actually, there was another copy made of this painting, but for the sake of argument, there was just one of these paintings by Watteau. But when this print was made after the painting, this print, in addition of a few hundred, traversed the globe. It disseminated this image across the globe quite literally. And that's the wonder of what prints can do. So it does kind of get, because it's after a painting, that doesn't make it a lesser object. That means it's showing all the things that prints could do in the 18th century. And it's also incredibly modern. We're looking into a painting shop, and if you look around at the people, they're actually very well. There are two gentlemen in the center who are looking at the nudes cavorting in the landscape in that painting, that round painting. But everyone else is kind of checking each other out. I mean, this is a very modern view of shopping and sociability, a smart and charming image. And to speak to photography, this is a 2009 cyanotype, a photograph by the artist Christian Marclay, and it's called Cassette Grid Number 10. The cornerstone of our photography collection is the works that Edward Muybridge did for the Stanford family. And so when I'm looking at photographs and even contemporary photographs, I very much appreciate contemporary artists who are mindful of 19th century processes, like the cyanotype, and they're using them to do something new, fresh, and exciting, like Marclay did in this photograph. And what really charms me about this thing is that cyanotype is an outdated, antiquarian, avant-garde process. And cassette tapes are kind of dead technology as well. And yet he's combined the two in a way that makes this wonderful formal study. And yet there are these remnants, there are these ghosts of both processes in it. A challenge for us collecting photographs like this is to take very good care of them because the blues can be fugitive, the medium itself can be very fugitive. And also whenever you buy something contemporary, a curator really has to think, what is this going to mean in 10 years? How does this relate to the rest of the collection? When you're buying and contemporary art can be quite expensive. So when you're making that kind of investment and building a collection, you really do want to try to think forward and think, oh, how is this going to resonate and how is it going to look in relation to what we already have on down the road?
Thank you, Elizabeth. Julie Muniz is the Associate Curator of Crafts and Decorative Arts at the Oakland Museum of Art.
It's actually the Oakland Museum of California.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oakland Museum of California. It's a common mistake. But actually, I think I clarify just because part of our mission is to collect the art history and natural sciences of California. And I'm in the art department, and each discipline collects slightly differently, has different parameters under which they collect. But in the art department, we look and collect objects that are made by California people, California natives, or people that have moved into the state who have worked and studied here. We also collect objects that somehow speak to the California experience. And so I'm going to show some pieces. Okay, this is, I'm sorry, it threw me off. The picture's a little bit distorted. But so I'm like, is that sideways? No. So this is a wonderful ring that we just recently got in by Margaret Tapata. And the Oakland Museum has one of the largest, actually the largest collection of Tapata jewelry in the world. We just recently had a wonderful exhibition of it that traveled to New York. Featuring the Tapata jewelry because she was really very much influenced by the constructivists and her mentor, Moholy-Nagy. So we're really blessed to have this collection. A lot of it came directly from her estate, from her husband, and from friends and family that knew her. She was had lived in the Bay Area for quite a large period during her life, and subsequently, finally, when she deceased, she was living in California. In Oakland. And because we have such a large collection of Tapata, I have to be very judicious when I look at new pieces. This was offered to us as a gift from an estate, and I'm fortunate. I'm lucky to have this problem of people knowing that we have this wonderful collection. And so when they have Tapata jewelry, when it comes up, a lot of times people will call me and say, "Would you like this for the museum?" And while it's tempting to say yes, I want it all, I have to think realistically about what it means to take in an object. And is that object best in our collection? Is it duplicative of some of the other pieces that we have already, Tapata work that we have in our collection? Is it too similar to something we already have? Would this piece be better off served in another museum's collection, perhaps, that doesn't have any Tapata jewelry and helps show a different audience what her work was like? So I have to consider that really carefully before I accept a piece and make sure that it really is going to benefit our collection, even though it's already a collection strength. How is it going to strengthen it even further? So with this piece, I was really excited to see it because, first of all, it's made out of 14-karat gold, and a lot of the Tapata jewelry that we have is sterling silver. So it's nice to have a few gold pieces in the collection to have some diversity in the case and so that there's some bling to look at as well as the sterling silver. The other thing that's really wonderful about this piece is you'll see the cut of the gemstone. It's a citrine quartz, which was a common, she used a lot of quartz in her jewelry. So it's very much in line with the other pieces that she's done. And it's used, the way it's cut is something that she's very much known for. She worked with a lapidarian in San Francisco named Francis Spearson, and together they worked on these new types of cutting gemstones. And so you can see that it has kind of this checkerboard pattern, and it's also kind of curved along the top to kind of provide distortion if you place something underneath. It'll distort the object. She was really interested in this. But she hasn't placed anything underneath it. A lot of times she would have placed an object behind the quartz to show that distortion. And in addition, you can see that it's kind of have these biomorphic elements on the side of the quartz, which is reminiscent of her early period. So I can tell from this that it's kind of right at that transition stage in her career, moving from her early period, her early work, where she's just starting to experiment with the quartz. And so for these reasons, I really was excited to take it into our collection and accept this gift.
Julie, I'm sorry, just a minute for the next two slides.
Okay, sorry. This next slide is by an artist named Bill Starkey, and he was not a California native. He actually grew up in Oklahoma and moved to Lodi later on in his life. But he was a folk artist. He made these wonderful instruments by hand. They all play music, and we recently purchased three of his musical instruments for our folk collection. So this was a really wonderful thing that came to us kind of out of the blue. We weren't looking for his work, but it was presented to us because people knew that we had a great folk collection and we were interested in collecting art. And we were really excited by these really wonderful pieces of guitars and cellos and things that he was making out of just found materials. So it shows that art can be made by not just practiced, educated, artists, but also regular people make art every day. And then finally, I have these wonderful horse heads, which are by an artist named Jaime Guerrero. These are currently on view right now at the Oakland Museum in the Playing with Fire exhibition, which is open until the end of March. I curated it, so I encourage you to go see it. And we actually purchased these partly in honor of the exhibition, which honors the 50th anniversary of American Studio Glass. They're wonderful. They're all each horse head is life size, and it's free blown glass. So it wasn't made with a mold. It's sculpted as the artist is blowing and working that hot molten glass. So it's really a tour de force just to think about the process in itself. But in addition to that, what we really loved about these pieces is it speaks to Jaime's Mexican-American heritage. And the Oakland Museum really thinks a lot about its community and the audience that's going to be looking at these pieces. We have a lot of Latinos in Oakland, and they come to our museum, and they want to see part of themselves reflected in the art that they see. So this is a wonderful story. He grew up in a family of churros, or the Mexican cowboys, and it's partly his memories of his uncles and his father and grandfather participating in these Mexican rodeos. And every time they won a prize, they would get a flower adorning the horse's reins. So it was kind of a family competition to see who could have the most flowers, but that's what the flowers represent.
Thank you, Julie. Finally, we have Forrest McGill, Chief Curator of the Asian Art Museum.
Hi, everybody. This is a painting by a Chinese-American artist named Zheng Chongbin. Excuse me. He's about 50, born in Shanghai, moved to this country 25 years ago. Several interesting things about it. One is I think a lot of people don't think about the Asian Art Museum as a place that actively collects contemporary art, but we do. Also, this was our first and so far only commission. We very seldom have money for acquisitions. We're normally dependent on gifts for acquisitions. But in this instance, we had some money, and a colleague of mine in our Chinese department knew the work of this artist, admired it very much, and worked with the artist to create this work. It's ink and acrylic on paper, and it's 24 feet across, so it's enormous, and especially enormous for work on paper, and so it raises all kinds of conservation issues. Also, it was going to go on view for a while in a very large case with sliding glass windows. And, of course, there were issues about how do you get it into the case, because if it's 24 feet across, it's pretty challenging to get inside a case. So the curator had to work with the artist to figure out how to make it in panels that were disassemblable and so on to be able to get it into the case. Then these are three pieces from a collection of about 50 pieces of gold jewelry from mostly from Indonesia, some from the Philippines, that were given to us by a longtime supporter family of the museum. And besides the wonderful quality and fantastic nature of these pieces of gold jewelry and the one in the middle is a headdress that if I were wearing it on my head, it would be taller than my arm. One of the interesting things that I thought would be interesting to you is the collection was about twice this big. Most of the collection was offered to us, and we couldn't take about half of it because of provenance issues. You know, UNESCO Convention requires us to be able to trace provenance to before 1970, and there was no specific suspicion about these pieces, but there was not the documentation to prove that they had been out of their country of origin before 1970. Or in a couple of instances, there were receipts, but the receipt said, you know, gold ring. Well, you can't prove that the gold ring referred to in the receipt is this gold ring. There's no photograph, there's no dimensions, so you can't match the piece of paper with the object. So we were really, really saddened that the oldest and arguably the greatest pieces in the collection we could not accept as gifts. Then these are three sections of what once was a very long hand scroll, painted in 1854, just at the time that Admiral Perry was signing the treaty with the Japanese to reopen Japan to interaction with the rest of the world. Extremely rare. It's rather folkish. It's not painted by a highly trained artist. But the fact that it was painted by a Japanese artist in 1854, the year of the so-called reopening of Japan by Admiral Perry, representing the odd appearances and the odd doings of these strange Americans who had shown up in Japan, makes it extremely interesting. The once very long hand scroll had long ago in Japan been divided into 30 sections, all mounted separately as individual hanging scrolls, and they were all acquired at some point before 1963 by the Japan Society of Northern California. They're not an art collecting institution. These hand scrolls were living under the desk of the director of the Japan Society of Northern California for decades. They had long wanted to find a home for them. The Asian Art Museum had long wanted them, but their board was uncertain what to do. They didn't feel that they could absolutely give them away because they were part of the accumulated property of the Japan Society of Northern California. So last year, after a lot of negotiation, an agreement was reached whereby we bought them, but they donated a substantial part of their value. So these extremely interesting and rare representations by a Japanese artist in 1854 of these odd newly arrived Americans have now got a permanent museum home.
Thank you, Forrest. You've each spoken about items that define your collection, but what about those materials that no longer make sense? Deaccessioning, the process of donating, trading, or selling an item from a collection, is really only spoken about when there is a mistake. It is usually sensational. Last year, for example, Berkeley misplaced a carved redwood relief by artist Sargent Johnson, and he sold it to the Huntington in Pasadena to the Huntington for $150. It was worth over $1 million, not to mention the worth to the collection. But here's the thing. In reality, those mistakes are actually quite rare. And most institutions do deaccession responsibly. So can each of you discuss a particular deaccession or your institution's general philosophy on deaccessioning?
I'll talk about an easy one. You know, we have geographic boundaries that make it easy for us. So we'll have something like Sanborn fire insurance maps, which are those huge ledgers. And we had a bunch from Daly City, and we decided to give them to Daly City Historical Society. So that was something that was an easy deaccession.
Well, I've only been at the Cantor for about 2 years, so I have not witnessed an actual deaccession process there, but I know that they are undertaken. It's few and far between, and they're very carefully dealt with because we have to do an incredible amount of documentation, not just provenance, but physically documenting, photographing, the object, bring in multiple experts that have no connection to us to give their own opinion of what's going on. So I know, I think every curator has some things that are set aside to be deaccessioned. I'm waiting till they reach kind of critical mass, and then I can begin this process. But I know that the ethical issues force us to take it very, very seriously, and I prefer to engage into preemptive deaccessioning, which when I can, which means working really closely with collectors and donors to be sure that we absolutely understand each other and what they're giving us, that it's right for our collection, and if it's not right, I am more than happy to point them in the direction of other institutions that would benefit from it. Mm-hmm. There is always a place that can benefit tremendously from something that's not right for us, and so I'm happy to kind of guide that as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, if you don't mind, Alexis, I'm going to kind of not directly answer the question, but
that's
talk a little bit about the issue of deaccessioning and how it pertains to the Oakland Museum, because our history is a little bit interesting. We actually originated as three separate institutions with different collecting policies, and we didn't become the Oakland Museum of California until 1969, and then our collecting parameters really became about California. So in our collections, we have a lot of what we call the orphans, and they are everything, the Snow Museum of Natural History, which is one of our predecessor institutions, it has things like snow tigers and stuffed elephants and giraffes and things, obviously not native California species. And so really technically no longer belong in the collection, but we still keep them because it's part of the institutional history. And actually something that's kind of interesting is that a few years ago, an artist named Mark Dion came and he kind of mined our collections. He did a project in collaboration with the museum to look through our collection. He was very interested in actually, he's the one that termed them the orphans of the collection. And he actually dug out some of these things and put them on display and was interested in the juxtapositions of what some of these things had and what they could say about the history of museums and museums collecting. So even though these objects are part of our history and maybe not really fitting into our collection, we actually are going through this whole kind of question about whether or not we should deaccession them, or whether or not we should hold on to them, and if they serve another purpose. So we're just starting to look at this, and I don't have answers to that yet. Probably it'll take a lot of discussions and thinking about that before we take any action on it. But I do think that it's an interesting approach to deaccessioning and looking at the parameters of your collection.
It came up for the Asian Art Museum when we moved. As you know, we used to be in Golden Gate Park, and we moved to the present location at Civic Center 10 years ago. And before we were moving, obviously, we're inventorying the collection. We're looking at all the collection and storage. And we ended up deaccessioning and selling at auction about 75 pieces of Indian and Southeast Asian stone sculpture. We have very large and excellent collection of Indian and Southeast Asian stone sculpture, and these were pieces that were very fragmentary or that were more or less duplicative or that just were not of the kind of interest that they were ever going to be shown. And we just didn't want to move them and then find storage for them in the new facility, so we did deaccession them. But that's the last time we've deaccessioned anything.
Whether an item is purchased, donated, or best of all, rediscovered in the archives, there is often a really good story associated with it. Perhaps something undervalued was spotted at a donor's house, as Forrest has certainly experienced in San Francisco. Other times, there is the story of loss and heartbreak when an institution receives a gift that someone from someone who's recently died, they get to know his or her widow or their families, as Susan briefly touched upon. Other times, the acquisition is kind of an unequivocal triumph, right? You really wanted something for the collection. You very much desired it, and you got it. Please share one of these kinds of acquisition stories with us. And since I somewhat, sort of already offered Forrest's story, maybe we'll start with him.
Well, I can't claim that this happens very often, that we discover something. But 4 or 5 years ago, I was a very kind collector invited me and a couple of other curators to come to his house and look at his collection and so on. And after we were looking at the art collection, my eye kept being drawn to a pair of very, very, very handsome chairs. And I said, "Are those by Lockwood DeForest by any chance?" And he said, I don't know who is Lockwood DeForest. Lockwood DeForest was a very important turn of the 19th to 20th century American designer who worked with Louis Comfort Tiffany, and he was the first major American designer that I know of who went to India, and he actually went into business with an Indian company. And the American designed Indian style furniture and had it fabricated in India, and then it was shipped back to the U.S. and sold by Tiffany, and it ended up being the furniture in the Brandeis University Library and in the, you know, mansions in New York City and so on. So I saw these chairs and thought, you know, could this be Lockwood DeForest? And to make a long story short, it turned out, yes, they were, and the donor did give them to the museum, but only after getting enormously interested himself in diving into the Lockwood DeForest bibliography and ending up knowing 100 times more than I did.
Well, you know, I actually have an interesting story about that as well. Not at the Oakland Museum. I've been at the Oakland Museum for just short of 5 years now, and so I still feel like I'm making a lot of those discoveries. It's a large collection, and I think it really does take a curator decades. That's why we're in our jobs forever. It takes you decades to learn a collection and really feel like you know it. And up until that time, you're always kind of discovering these things in the collection. But I do have an interesting story of an object that was discovered in the collection at the Connecticut Historical Society, where I worked at one time about, this was probably close to 10 years ago, I guess. And this was a very important flag that was hanging from Lincoln's box when he went to the theater one night. And this happened to wind up at the Connecticut Historical Society, and it was lost in the collections. They didn't really realize what it was, and it was just sort of discovered. And that happens sometimes. You don't like to admit it, but, you know, one object gets moved from here to over, you know, on another shelf just a step above, and all of a sudden, you know, if it's not recorded in your record keeping, it's lost, and it's lost for a long time until some very diligent registrar goes through and does a massive inventory and discovers it. So this is an object that kind of went through that, and it took a long time for them to do the research to figure out what it was and what they really had. And yes, it was the flag that was on Lincoln's theater box when he was assassinated. So it made a lot of news, and it had to go through a lot of restoration as well. But they were very, very excited to find it.
The story that comes to mind for me is more, in a way, personal than institutional, but the two are related. So I've been at the Cantor a very short time, and I've spent a lot of that time in storage going box by box, getting to know the drawings, the prints, the photographs. And there was one day when I was alone in storage, and I didn't look at the front of the box to figure out what was in it. I just grabbed a box and thought, okay, we'll work on this aisle today. And I pulled out these ledger books that had like crayon or colored pencil scribbles and little animals and precisely drawn little houses. And I thought, where am I in the right storage room? What am I looking at? And then I realized these were Leland Jr.'s notebooks that he'd had when he was, and I flipped over, it's like when he was five, when he was, you know, doodling. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks that, you know, that museum was there. It was founded as a memorial after young Leland died. But the foundation of the entire museum's collection, or not just, you know, these like these wonderful little artifacts that belonged to the Stanfords, but all the things that little Leland gathered while he was traveling. And we really started off as a little boy's cabinet of wonder and have grown to be a university art museum. And it was just kind of a wonderful moment for me as a curator.
I think, you know, what makes this job so fun is that you never know what's going to walk in the door. And I think we've all had that experience where someone's like, I have something great. It's from the 60s. And I'm like, the 1860s, the 1960s, you know. And they're like, it's really old. And it's, you know, it's like, well, it's not so old. But and then there's people who just come in and say, well, I don't know. This might be of interest to you. So I got a call from Al Bernal of the Bernal family, the Bernal Rancho in San Francisco, and he had his family papers, and he thought, you know, they had a fire up where they lived in the foothills, and they should donate them to us for safekeeping. And it is, in fact, many of the Bernal. There's lots of branches of the family, but it's many of the Bernal papers and correspondence, you know, going back to the 1700s when the ranchos were settled. And, you know, one of the first things we pulled out was a love letter saying, you know, the woman was accusing him, you don't love me, you're stealing away to town. It's all in Spanish, and I had somebody on staff translate, and he's, no, my love, I will be back tonight, and love you always, you know. And it's just one of those things that you don't expect, and it's so wonderful when that turns up.
So we'll now turn to the questions from our audience.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the Member-Led Arts Forum, and you're listening to a panel on recent acquisitions of San Francisco Bay Area museums.
So this question is directed to Susan, but I think that all of the panelists can speak to this. It's really interesting because this question suggests that perhaps a way of raising revenue for the archives would be to publish things from the archives. But I think, as we all know from exhibitions, and we make very expensive books that people don't buy and end up being a great loss to museums. So whoever wrote this, please buy all the books. and so do you want to speak to any ideas about, you know, I think maybe a, you know, a book of prostitutes or something like that they were thinking, Susan?
Right. I mean, we've thought about, right now we're publishing on the web just to put our stuff out there and have people see it and retweet it. And, you know, social media is really a big thing for us right now. I mean, I think our desire is to be more well-known than to raise money. The city's doing okay right now, although we don't have a huge acquisitions budget at all. We could publish. I don't know how much money we would make. We've also thought about marketing. You know, the Park Service, they used a lot of our images, and they're doing these fabulous tote bags and mugs. And I need to talk to them and see if they're really raising money from all these things, because that's something I've thought about, too.
We do publish books at the Oakland Museum quite frequently, and yes, Alexis, you're right, they generally aren't money makers. You usually do it as a loss, just because you do it as part of your duty to provide scholarship and get the information out there, and it's just part of your mission as a museum to do that kind of thing. But like was just mentioned, you know, we are looking into ideas of the licensing of images as well. So putting them in jewelry, tote bags, that kind of thing. Our store is looking into that, and I think that's something that things like places like the Met Museum has their wonderful museum store where they've done wonderful jobs with the licensing of pieces of jewelry and you know, 18th century paintings and Greco-Roman jewelry and anything they can think of, really. And so I think that's really the model that a lot of museums are looking at.
And then a sort of related question. Several people were interested in the relationship between the internet and the museum, and the panelists and I were talking about this ahead of the start. The internet is great because everyone can start Tumblrs and can have pictures and stories and on the sixth floor blog, but then the problem is people feel like they've had their experience with the museum, and then they don't go to exhibitions, and then they definitely don't buy the books. So can we talk about your relationship with the internet? Whoever would like to start.
Well, at the Cantor right now, our most complicated, but I think ultimately rewarding relationship they're engaging with regards to the internet is we are getting, our entire collection is now online, even if it's just a record, and we're getting everything photographed, and the curators and their assistants are undergoing the exhaustive process of verifying data. And we feel like that is such a priority, just to get that information out there. So not just people internationally, because we do get international scholars occasionally say, oh, you have that drawing, ah, I have to come see it. But just so that students and faculty can teach more easily around our collections. So that's really what we're focusing on right now.
You know, as a public library and as a city institution, I feel like we have to put as much as we can online and make it freely and publicly available, and that's really a huge part of our mission. And right now we have about 40,000 photographs online. If you want a really good quality to use in a commercial use, you do have to come license it from us. But everybody else can use those photographs. We're partnering with Internet Archives. We have many of our books online, our most popular materials, city directories. We're partnering with David Rumsey and putting some of our maps online. So that's a huge part of what we do. It really drives what we do.
We're struggling to keep up. We have about half of our collection online with good photographs and good information and so on in a publicly accessible database. We used to, Susan's interesting blog at the library was mentioned. We used to have quite an active blog, and we've made an institutional decision to de-emphasize it because there were simply not enough hits. And we've, everything is migrating to Twitter and other social media. We have a person who's half of whose job is to just do Twitter stuff, and she will soon be made full-time, and we may be hiring a second person just to generate social media stuff and keep up with it. So we're struggling to not be using yesterday's media and yesterday's ways of interacting.
The Oakland Museum also, I mean, I think this is something that all museums everywhere are going through, trying to digitize collections and trying to get them online and out there, because not everybody is able to go to your institution. Not everybody lives, you know, close by. You can reach a much larger audience through the internet. So we recognize the value of that. We do recognize the value of social media, and we have people. We also have a staff person who does nothing but post Facebook and organizes our social media. And I know, what a job, right? So, you know, we're working on that too. I don't think, though, that we're worried about people not coming to the museum because they can see the image online, because, you know, we try to emphasize the experience at the Oakland Museum, and there's, you can't replicate the experience of actually seeing a large Thomas Hill painting, 19th century landscape painting, through a little tiny JPEG on your screen. It's just, you know, and even through Google Art Project, which will uber, you know, high-res image, and you can get up really close to see every little brush stroke of the Van Gogh, I don't think it really gives you the same kind of experience. And so that's what the museum is really trying to emphasize, is the experience of coming in to actually see these objects.
If I can just pick up on that, we continue to count on the idea that people want to be in the presence of the real thing. And we look at the National Archives in Washington. I mean, any of us can see reproductions of the Declaration of Independence very easily, and still people line up in the thousands in the snow to go in and be in the presence of the one.
Yeah.
So we're hoping that will continue to be true.
Many of these questions have to do with provenance. And so can you talk about how you go about tracing the roots of a possible donation or purchase, and what happens when you turn it away? A lot of these questions ask who took some of the collection that you turned away. I don't know if you want to touch that, but to discuss provenance briefly?
Well, it's tough, and this is an issue that I think museum people and cultural officials all over the world are trying to figure out. When museums can't take things, where are they supposed to go? And there's no answer. They just stay in private collections. They go into garage sales. They go into the market and are sold and resold. It doesn't seem to me that this is the solution in the long run. It doesn't seem to me there's any benefit for the world for things not to be able to enter public collections. On the other hand, every time a public collection accepts a 1,000-year-old Cambodian piece of sculpture, it's encouraging the pillaging of Cambodian sculpture. So it's a dilemma that has no answer that I know of at the moment, and we're constantly involved in the national and international dialogues about this, and there's no solution that I know of.
And we should point out that we in America have very few dedicated law enforcement officers who look into this, whereas in Italy they have hundreds and hundreds and departments dedicated to this. Mm-hmm. Anything else? If we could switch back to a question about what happens when you actually then get the acquisition and you are sure about where it came from, do you immediately put it up on exhibition, on display? Do you try to incorporate into something that's already going on, or is it sent often straight to the conservation lab or keeping it close to your desk?
I think that's actually a question I get a lot from people when they're thinking about making a donation, is what's going to happen to this object? You know, I want to see it, make sure it goes up on the wall, or so that people can enjoy it. I think they have that vision of Raiders of the Lost Ark, that last scene where it just gets put up in a storage and nobody ever sees it again. And I know that that's definitely the fear of a lot of potential donors out there. At the Oakland Museum, we strive to make a lot of rotations through our core galleries as much as possible. A lot of times that's we have difficulty doing that because we also have a very active exhibition schedule, and staff time and resources just are at a limit, especially in today's age and economy. But we do try to get things out there. And if we have a new acquisition that we really want to make sure it gets put out there, we will plan it into one of our rotation schedules so it can go up into the core galleries. If it was purchased, or if there was during a time where we're planning an exhibition where it might fit in, we consider that, of adding that to the checklist for the exhibition. I wish it could stay in my office, actually. I had to pry an object out of a curator's office earlier today because it hadn't been handed over to collections, and I'm like, it really can't stay in there. But we do try to get things out there as much as possible and rotate.
And for me at the Cantor, as a curator of works on paper, light-sensitive materials, it's fortunately, I guess, I have to do a lot of rotations. And so I am, when I acquire things, I am thinking in the short term, what do I have coming up that this could be just like a gem-like little feature object that'll slip right into something I'm about to do, or which acquisitions are more long-term planning for larger exhibitions to build bridges between objects that we have. We might not show them soon, but once we get that object, that opens a new door that enables us to plan different types of exhibitions in the future. And we do try to be systematic. When something comes in, a conservator looks at it, it goes to matting and framing and gets proper housing, and then it comes back to storage, and then we can play with it.
We do. We have one case in the room, and we often put new to the collection or new to the library pieces in there, just because we're so excited and proud, and we want to show it to people. People enjoy that.
And things that are donated may not at the Asian Art Museum may not get shown immediately. But another possibility that I suspect all of us do is to lend things to exhibitions and other museums. If I can put in a plug. If you've been through the United Terminal recently, you've seen that there's a big exhibition of Indian stone sculpture at the United Terminal, and that includes several recent acquisitions. So things are getting exposed, even if they don't go on permanent view in our galleries. They get exposed, they get looked at, they may get published, they get lent to exhibitions, and so on.
And so when we talk about things that we find in the archives, of course, that means that things are also lost. Can we talk a bit about pieces that go missing for a short period of time, for a longer period of time, that show up, you know, across the ocean somewhere else?
No.
No.
That never happens.
No one's touching that. All right.
So I would say not. I mean, in my experience, not a lot goes missing.
Right. Yeah. More is found.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And that has to do with the fact that people do have these careers, these jobs for 20, 40
right.
years,
mm-hmm.
and then two years in, it's really hard to figure out where they put something if they didn't write it down.
And the nightmare, if I may say,
yes,
the nightmare
please.
is when you know where the teapot is, but you don't know where the lid is.
And I know that when I came, good records were not kept before I was there. I was the first real archivist to be hired by the city. Mm-hmm. So somebody did not keep donation records the way I do it now, or an accession register. So sometimes a person will call and say, I donated this, you know, at some time, and we just don't have a good record of it. And that's, I can't do anything about it, you know, but we'll try to find the item.
And the process of creating these records also takes quite a bit of time.
Yes.
And that,
mm-hmm.
that is a part of introducing something new to the collection. It can take months, if not years. The most common question that we've received tonight has little to do with the collections and more to do with all of you and your career trajectories. How did you end up in your positions?
I was a history undergrad in college, and then I did a master's in library studies. And then I worked for Senator Cranston as his archivist in Washington, D.C. I worked with political papers. I was on Senate staff for a few years. And then I went back with another master's in history and then came out into this job. So very interested in political papers and history.
As an undergraduate, I studied printmaking and history and women's studies and Spanish literature and had no idea what I would do with any of that. But somehow when I was investigating graduate school, I saw art history. So I got an MA and then had the opportunity to be just total luck. I applied for an internship at the Fogg Museum at Harvard.
Yeah.
And said, I'm interested in prints, and they took a chance on me, and it was just, that was it. After I did that internship, I got my PhD, print studies all the way through, worked at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston for 3 years, and then came here. So it's not very exciting. After I found what I liked, I just kind of latched onto it like a bulldog, basically, and just followed it through.
I had a similar story, actually. I spent my undergraduate career actually not sure what I was going to study and wandered into an art history class one day, and the rest is history. It was really kind of that light going. The light went on as the lights went off. Actually, back in the day when we used to sit in the dark and watch those slides go by, and from there I went in. I discovered that I was really interested in decorative arts, so I found a program in New York, studied history of decorative arts, got my MA, and was very lucky. I think it takes a bit of luck to get into this career, because there's a lot of people that would love to do what we do. I feel very lucky and privileged to be able to have made it up to a curator and not slip my wrist crying to find the next job when my funding runs out. So I'm very, very proud.
If I can speak about a colleague instead of myself, I think she has the ideal background. Now associate curator that we hired a few years ago, has a PhD in Islamic art history and an MBA. So that's the, these days, that's the combination that's needed.
True.
I'm told that was our last question, and so I am drawing this session to a close. Thank you so much to our panelists and to all of you for coming. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you.
Have a round of applause for our fabulous panel. It was really excellent. I think we all learned a lot. I know I did. I heard phrases I haven't heard before, and I learned something about this wonderful world of acquisitions. So thank you, audience, and thank you to our listening audience. And now this discussion. celebrating 108 years of enlightened discussion at the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.